Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the last session of the June 2021 Advocacy Sector Conversation Series. My name is Melissa Hayo and I'm the coordinator of the Disability Advocacy Resource Unit. I would like to begin by acknowledging the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, the traditional custodians of the land on which I am coming to you from today, and pay my respect to their elders past, present and emerging. I extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people here today. I also acknowledge that sovereignty was never ceded and that this always was and always will be Aboriginal land. Once again, we're delivering the Advocacy Sector Conversations Forum to you online. We hope at some stage to be able to deliver this series face-to-face when it's safe to do so in an inclusive and accessible way. However, we hope that you've all settled in comfortably and are ready for a fantastic series this week. We encourage your active participation today, so please type your questions in the Q&A box, and at the end of the session, I will facilitate a Q&A session with our presenter. The last session of our series is Gateways and Gatekeepers, an exploration of the issues facing people with episodic mental illness during the transition to the NDIS. Dr. Liz Hudson will present the findings from her PhD research, which involved exploring the experiences of people with psychosocial disability during the transition to the NDIS. She discovered that system-level structural barriers and rationing decisions applied by NDIS staff do indeed lead to differential pathways for people experiencing mental illness. Please welcome Liz Hudson.
Thank you, Melissa, and welcome everybody. The title of my research, Gateways and Gatekeepers, an exploration of the issues facing people with episodic mental illness during transition to the National Disability Insurance Scheme, the NDIS, in many ways depicts or symbolises pathways. And there are pathways on many levels. So there was the transition from traditional block funding to disability services for people with disability into individualised funding under the National Disability Insurance Scheme. So that's a pathway of transition for service providers, but also for service users. And there were, in my research, I discovered pathways, there were pathways, different pathways for people with psychosocial disability. Some had the pathway of acceptance into the NDIS. Some had alternate pathways where they were rejected by the NDIS. And that led to, I guess, pathways to recovery, either opportunities or risks associated, depending on whether the pathway to acceptance or rejection was achieved. This is also, my research is about my own pathway. I'm going to begin by just telling you a little bit about my background and my interest in this research. I came to be interested in doing a doctorate of studies based on my professional experience as both a research manager and CEO of a mental health organisation, community-based mental health organisation. The latter role was as a research manager for a large disability organisation that also provided employment support to people with mental illness. I was anticipating doing a doctorate because I wanted, I guess, to legitimise my role as a research manager in an organisation. I hadn't actually studied research before. And so I was delighted to find a pathway into a PhD through a partnership between VCOS and RMIT. So the slide on the front, the first slide on the front, there are three logos on this page that I guess symbolise my pathway to being able to access support, financial support, to do my PhD. And that was through a partnership between VCOS, Victorian Council of Social Service, and RMIT University. And they formed a partnership called the Future Social Service Institute, which was funded by the state government, but also a contribution by other organisations as well, the two partner organisations as well. So I was thrilled to be able to take up the opportunity to do a scholarship that was funded by this partnership. And I am very grateful for that to occur. And it's helped me for the reason for being here today. Whilst the NDIS presents opportunities for many eligible people experiencing psychosocial disability, a range of existing services have been or will be replaced by the NDIS, creating a problem for those who are ineligible. There are 690,000 people, Australians, living with severe mental illness. 64,000 of them will be NDIS eligible at any time point in time. Therefore, up to 91% of ineligible NDIS ineligible for NDIS, they rely on non-NDIS mental health supports, which might be mainstream supports or existing services. At the national level, three major mental health service programs, FAMS, the Disability Living and PIR, will actually close as a result of the NDIS, and many have already. Of particular note is the unique situation in Victoria, where under the bilateral agreements, all state community mental health services will be replaced by the NDIS. I guess justifying the focus of my research on researching people's experience of the NDIS, not just those who were eligible and had access to the NDIS, but what was the result for those who were ineligible? What did that mean for them? What kind of future did they have? At the time of my research, all existing community mental health services in Victoria were being replaced by the NDIS. Since my research, there has been a small amount of funding to try and support those that for whom there are service gaps, which I'm really pleased to see because that wasn't the experience during the period of my research. However, it's still inadequate. It still doesn't, I guess, support those remaining 91% who will be ineligible for the NDIS. So, serendipitously, I think, the NDIS commenced the first year of my PhD in 2016, and full rollout happened to actually coincide with the end of my PhD in 2020. I'd like to say that this is the result of well-planned design, but the truth, it is the product merely of coincidence. During 2018 and 2019, as you can see on this slide, is the period of time when I commenced my data collection. That's where I interviewed people with psychosocial disability about their experiences of transitioning from traditional services to individualised funding under the NDIS. So my research, the timeline, actually mirrored the timeline of the full rollout of the NDIS. And I was interested in interviewing both eligible and ineligible NDIS participants because my research was positioned to, I guess, shine a spotlight on the impacts of ineligibility at both individual and societal levels. So my analysis, drawn from first-hand accounts collected from both NDIS participants, both ineligible and ineligible, and also NDIS practitioners, the people who worked for the NDIS or worked for partners of the NDIS, employed as planners or local area coordinators, I guess revealed that for the individual, ineligibility leads to an uncertain future as existing community mental health supports were withdrawn, negatively affecting their recovery and well-being. And this also has, I guess, a broader impact. Structural barriers at the system level and rationing decisions applied by NDIS professionals serving as gateway operators to the scheme led to different differential pathways and service gaps, and raising some issues around notions of social justice and fairness in the system. I expand on this further in my presentation as I talk about the findings from my research. But first, I'll give you an overview of my research. So I interviewed in total 30 people. So it was a qualitative research approach, and I interviewed 20 people with experiencing mental illness. People experiencing mental illness are also used throughout my presentation. I use the term people with psychosocial disability because that is the term that is used by the NDIS and is also the term that the Consumers and Carers Forum Network adopted as a term to identify people with experiencing mental illness whose disability actually impacts the way that they can function in everyday life. I recruited 30 interview participants, as I said, 20 of whom experienced mental illness or psychosocial disability, and 10 of whom were NDIS professionals. So this, the focus of my research on, you can see on the left-hand side of the slide in the sort of mustard yellow, that there were 13 participants who were eligible, 3 of whom were from regional Victoria and 10 were from Melbourne. And then on the right side of your slide in the red, they're the ones that are separated by the slide image into the ineligible. And two of whom I interviewed from regional Victoria and 5 of whom I interviewed from Metro Melbourne. The regional Victorian areas that I covered were Ballarat, Echuca and Bendigo. You'll note that nearly 19 out of the 20 of the participants with psychosocial disability experience episodic mental illness. Episodic mental illness means that the person can experience periods of feeling very well and then fluctuate or punctuated by periods of feeling unwell. This may impact their ability to be able to participate in work, or they may actually be hospitalised or go through, have experienced a period of psychosis. So for 19 out of the 20 of the participants, they identified as having episodic mental illness. The one person who didn't was actually, he had complex needs, including dual disability of intellectual disability and mental illness, and had struggled with understanding what I was meaning by episodic. I guess it's a learning for me too, to be more clear when using the language for my research. So the interviews with the NDIS professionals, this graph here shows you that the local area coordinators are represented by the mustard coloured part of the bar graph, and the blue part of the bar graph represents the number of planners that interviewed. So I interviewed 10 NDIS professionals overall, and there were 2 people that I interviewed in regional Victoria and 8 of whom were in Metro Melbourne. There's this graph just shows you also some interesting, I guess, statistics or demographics about the NDIS professionals I interviewed. The 8 of the participants were women, 2 were men, and overwhelmingly a majority were degree qualified. And I was also impressed by the kind of level of experience in mental health, that the average sort of level of experience was, you know, about 5 to 10 years in mental health, which was fantastic. And I guess it was a surprise in my research. The role of local area coordinators versus planners is that the National Disability Insurance Agency planners are people that are employed by the agency or by the NDIS, and their role is to make decisions about funding levels for NDIS plans or support plans for participants. They also have a role in determining whether an applicant will be eligible or not. And they play a role in determining what goes into the plan, what kind of supports that the person will be eligible for. The local area coordinators have a similar role, but they're employed by partner organisations of the NDIS, such as Brotherhood of St Lawrence, and they actually have a similar role, but they don't make the final decision when it comes to the funding for the plans. So, explanation of key terms. The two terms that will be using during this presentation, or are using, is the one is the episodic psychosocial disability. And as I mentioned earlier, this is a definition that is used by the National Mental Health Consumer and Carer Forum, and it describes the term that they use to describe the disability experience of people with impairments and participation restrictions related to mental health conditions. These restrictions include loss of or reduced abilities to function, think clearly, experience full physical health, and manage the social and emotional aspects of their lives, often based on the social model of disability that they are confronted with barriers that make it difficult for them to actually enjoy a full quality of life because of the barriers, the societal barriers that are introduced for them. As I also mentioned, psychosocial disability is the term that is used by the NDIS. In episodic mental psychosocial disability is in the mental health context is where, as I mentioned before, a person's disability may vary in intensity, fluctuating between periods of living well and not so well. The other term that I'm going to be, that I'm introducing now, that I'll be using in my research throughout the presentation, is the term personal recovery. It's one of the major themes of my research, is what it means, what the NDIS means for participants in their recovery. Also, the NDIS promise that the personal recovery model is something that will be supported during the NDIS, and that their recovery is something that is front of mind when it comes to supports for people with psychosocial disability. So personal recovery is the lens I use to guide my research. And recovery is about achieving an optimal state of personal, social, and emotional well-being, as deemed by each individual. It is different from clinical recovery, which focuses on outcomes and the absence of symptoms. A person can experience personal recovery as having a movement away from pathology and illness toward that of wellness and personal resilience, while still acknowledging that they have a mental illness or a diagnosis of a psychiatric condition that may be permanent. They can still recover in other ways that is not just clinical and not just an absence of symptoms. So the aims of my research were to generate insights for future policy and practice by highlighting the consequences of NDIS design, rules and regulations, and eligibility determinations for people experiencing mental illness. I also had another aim, was to contribute new knowledge regarding access and equity, choice and control, recovery and social inclusion in the National Disability Insurance Scheme for people with psychosocial disability. So in every PhD research thesis, not just in, for PhDs, for any research, it's important to establish and have founded a research question, so that then we can confirm whether the research I've undertaken has actually answered the question that I raised in my research question. So the primary research question for me was, how are people who experience episodic mental illness affected by the NDIS design and governing processes that are actually enacted in policy, rules and regulations by NDIS planners and local area coordinators? Quite a mouthful for a primary research question. So then I looked at breaking it down into three sub-questions. So the first one is, how is access to the NDIS negotiated and understood? not just by the people with psychosocial disability, but also by the planners and the local area coordinators who are the gateway operators to the scheme. The second sub-research question is, what are the barriers to and facilitators of choice and control and personal recovery? And the third and final sub-research question are, what are the social justice implications of NDIS access and eligibility determinations for people experiencing mental illness? I'm going to briefly talk to you about the main findings, which seems a little odd to insert it at the sort of, I guess, the beginning part of my presentation, but I will return to the findings. I just want to give you, I guess, some context when I talk about the research and what were the results. I want to give you an overview of the main findings, so it does give you context when I'm taking you through some of the quotes and what the people experienced during my research. So, and I think that also that these main findings have policy implications for the design of the and the implementation of the NDIS. So I guess a key finding, which I've alluded to already, is that system level structural barriers and rationing decisions applied by NDIS professionals who serve as gateway operators to the scheme lead to different pathways for people experiencing mental illness. The first pathway is for those who are NDIS eligible, is I guess a pathway to greater access to choice and control and social inclusion and also recovery. In my research, there were many, I guess actually over 50% of the people who were eligible for NDIS were able to talk positively about their experience of the NDIS. They had some very positive experiences, ranging from, you know, life transforming to, you know, simple things like access to some funding to be able to take some driving lessons to drive so they could drive a car and give them more independence. So there definitely were some really positive outcomes in my findings, especially for people who were eligible for the NDIS. Some people who were eligible still had some concerns about the way the NDIS operated and some suggestions for some improvements, but majority were pretty happy with the funding they received and support they received. A different story for the other pathway. The second group, those who were ineligible, their future was less certain as funds were being directed away from existing services toward the NDIS, highlighting a service gap. Before I go on to the other findings, I'll just give you an example of that. There were a couple of examples. There was one of the interview participants from Ballarat prior to the NDIS was receiving support from the council to come and clean his house. He had experienced bipolar disorder, but also had a hoarding disorder. So he was reliant upon the council cleaner to come to his house. It was only once a fortnight. But as he said, it would gave him an opportunity to give him a start, to try and clean up and try and make his way through the chaos that was surrounding him. As soon as the NDIS came in, that funding through the council was stopped for him. He tried to apply for the NDIS, was ineligible. And so as a result, he doesn't have that cleaning support ongoing and is likely not to get it unless he reapplies for the NDIS funding, reapplies for the NDIS. The other example is a woman who was also receiving some local support for access to a community psychologist. And as soon as the NDIS came in, she no longer had that support. It wasn't clinical support. She was getting that from a psychiatrist. This was community and social support that helped her to engage with her social networks and family, and a very important to her recovery. That was no longer made available to her. So that demonstrates some of the consequences of this main finding, the difference between the two pathways. Main key findings were that greater flexible support was needed, which can be scaled up or down if needed to accommodate episodic nature of illness. And again, I'll talk to you about in more detail a bit later on. The third area was that mental health recovery knowledge by NDIS professionals is insufficient. That I talked about the mental health knowledge was good, but it's actually around the personal recovery model, which is different to the clinical model, as I talked about earlier, that was actually insufficient. And fourth and finally is that the insurance model design and implement policy structure falls short of innovatively meeting the needs of people with psychosocial disability. So as from these research questions, I guess emerged three themes. From the interviews I held with the participants, three main themes arose because, and they've actually addressed each of those questions. So the first sub-research question I mentioned before was the how is access to the NDIS negotiated and understood? And that the responses to that came up with a theme entitled Navigating the Eligibility Divide, Issues of Access and Equity. That was one theme. The second theme, which was around barriers and facilitators of choice and control and personal recovery, I actually talked about deconstructing choice and control. That's the theme two. So I took apart the words choice and control. And then the third research question, you know, what are the social justice implications? That came into under a theme called Shaping Recovery and Social Inclusion. In the following slides, I'll expand upon these observations by actually showing you some direct quotes from some of the people that participated in my research. So the first theme, navigating the eligibility divide, issues of access and equity. So the NDIS made a promise, not just at the, when we started rolling out the NDIS in 2016 at the beginning of my research, but actually, even at the trial phase, the promise was that the NDIS gives all Australians peace of mind that if their child or loved one is born with or acquires permanent and significant disability, they will get the support they need. This was what was something key that I wanted to explore in my research. See if this promise was being upheld or is likely to be upheld. This is a snapshot of the eligibility criteria for someone who has psychosocial disability. And so you can see that to be eligible for the NDIS, applicants must have a disability that is attributable to one or more impairments related to a psychiatric condition, and that the impairment is permanent and affects their capacity for social or economic participation. At the beginning of my research in 2016, I was interested in exploring what this term permanent meant and what impact it would have on for people who have episodic mental illness. And fortunately, it was terrific. I did not have to focus as much on eligibility around permanence that didn't recognise episodic mental illness because the Act was actually changed. There was some of the guidelines were changed and it included the term allowing for people with episodic disability, not just people with psychosocial disability, but there are other disabilities, for example, multiple sclerosis, other disabilities that have that fluctuate in and are episodic. So it was in recognition of that. So that was terrific, but that was a change at the beginning of my research. It was a good change. So in these slides, I'm going to talk about assessment in terms of accessing the NDIS, at three levels. One is assessment that occurs when somebody wants to apply for the NDIS and to get access. The second is assessment that relates to whether their request for funding support, the NDIS plan, all the supports and the funding levels that they request is accepted or not. And then at the the third level is whether they're actually accepted into the as part of the insurance scheme. So it's an assessment is actually a topic of currency. I don't know if you're aware, but it has been in the news quite a bit of the NDIS assessments. Their plan is to change or propose a change to the assessment process. And I'll talk a little bit later about what the different types of assessment are, how they compare from when my research was conducted to what is proposed now. This assessment process that is proposed now wasn't linked to my research, but it certainly has their assessment was something that I covered quite a bit in my research. So I think that it is relevant for me to discuss that today. So I'll talk to you about the key differences there and what from my research I can tell maybe the impact of these new assessments. But these the quotes that I've got on the screen now really, I guess, talk about the access to the NDIS. So Adef is actually her application for the NDIS was refused. And I'm just going to give you a little bit of background to Adef. Adef described herself before the NDIS as someone who is well, is a mother. She's a casual childcare worker, and she's trying to repair relationships with her family and friends. After applying for the NDIS feeling rejected, her mental health actually declined. She also talked about the loss of protection when she couldn't access a community psychologist that I just talked about earlier. And she said that when she is unwell, she changes from being mother, carer, childcare worker to patient who cedes parenting to her ex-husband, parenting controls, and to someone who is medicated. When she presented to the NDIS, she was experiencing a period of wellness, and it's sometimes described as the hidden disability, psychosocial disability or mental illness, because appearances can be that you appear well. Adet said that this actually damaged her opportunity to get access to the NDIS. And she says in this quote, "The NDIS are not taking people like me because I'm not mentally unwell enough to qualify. On the flip side, you can't get income protection or insurance, or you can't get travel insurance if you have a disability. So one system is telling you this, that you're not disabled enough. The other system is telling you that you are too disabled." It highlights the, complexity around an insurance scheme that's based on requirements of what's called reasonable and necessary standards. This is another example of an application to the NDIS, and this is a person who was also deemed ineligible. Charles was in regional Victoria, and he talked about the process of applying for the NDIS. I asked him, "Did anyone help you with the NDIS application?" He said, "Yes, but the workers didn't have any information about what was required. It was very new at this point, I should qualify that in. The workers just said, state the worst case scenario. You talk about the worst situation, not the best." And then I said, "How did that make you feel, talking about the worst?" And Charles said, "Awful. You feel disabled after that." So during my research, assessments were inconsistent and tended to focus on illness to ensure eligibility. In this case, Charles focused on his illness. He felt like he was labelled as being disabled and in the outcome was not positive for him. He did not get access to the NDIS. The quote, I guess, illustrates one of the themes discussed under this area of navigating the eligibility divide, and is an indication of how being labelled affects ineligible participants' well-being. So when I focused on this assessment, I was writing up this research. I was actually based on the experiences of people with mental illness when they talked about their application and focusing on the worst. I actually was critical of the existing assessment process at the time, which seemed to be focused on collecting as much information as possible about how debilitating the illness is and so forth, just so they could get through the NDIS. And I was really hoping that there would be a focus on sort of a strengths-based approach. The new assessment process, to its credit, has one element that I think that I do agree with, and that is that it is going to be focused on strengths rather than deficits. So these two quotes are actually from NDIS professionals, two planners, one in regional Victoria and one in Metro Melbourne. They describe the inconsistency in approach. So the first one is by Erica, regional Victoria, not her real name. None of the names that I use in these examples are real. And she talks about someone who was actually asked for some gym equipment to help their mental health recovery. You know, doing it's well documented and evidenced that physical health improvements leads to better mental health improvements. Erica says, "I can't see a reason why you wouldn't give access. The product is only worth $3,000, and other planners laugh at me about that. If it actually gives this family a quality of life, I'm going to agree to it. I'm the delegate. I'm going to put it through." Erica is talking about being the delegate of the NDIS CEO. As a planner, she is delegated the responsibility to make decisions about certain levels of access to plans. And in this case, she's very supportive of the gym equipment and recognising the importance of that. And as a delegate, she has the responsibility to be able to make that decision. She has the delegated authority to make that decision. So she's saying she sees the value in investing $3,000 for gym equipment. In contrast, Bree says categorically, "We never approve gym membership, ever. I mean, it's expensive. As much as we would love to, and especially I know how much exercise does help mental health, we can't do it." This quote comes from another one of the applicants who, actually NDIS eligible. She was delighted with her funding package. She got the best kind of, psychosocial support that she could ask for in her first year. But after being with the service, with the NDIS for a year, she was given, some advice from one of the people that worked in the field to say that it was unlikely that she was going to be able to use to have the similar amount of funding for therapeutical support after 1 year. The reason that was given that she would probably not get access to that level of funding again was because she did not use up all of her funds in the first year. The reason she didn't use up all her funds in the first year were for a couple of reasons. One, she had some difficulty finding the right level of support for her. The support worker was in demand. The other is that she actually had a period where she was feeling unwell and hospitalised, and so she couldn't even use any of her NDIS funds at the time. So her quote there, you know, she said, "I'm not looking forward to my assessment review. I'm not sure who'll be supporting me anymore. I just fear that my best interests aren't being looked after. I feel like I'm losing control in my own therapy. So I talked about the beginning of this theme around access and equity and, you know, navigating the eligibility divide. I talked about assessments having quite a lot of focus during this under this theme. So I thought I'd just spend a moment or two talking about assessments in current time. So it's not actually, about my research, but it does have some relevance for my research. And I believe that some of the findings from my research can have some impact or sway on how those assessments might be viewed, the new assessments. So the left-hand side tables describe the assessment requirements during the period of my research when I collected the data, when I interviewed the participants. So there was quite an involved process that in some cases took months to actually collect all the information. It was time consuming, but it did have some benefits. It meant that people were eligible. So in the current situation or during my research, the assessment is to be completed by the applicant's psychiatrist, GP, or their most appropriate clinician. In contrast, the proposed new NDIS assessments, the assessor is unknown to the applicant. It isn't the healthcare professional or the applicant usually sees. One of the disadvantages of that in terms of people, not just for psychosocial disability, but I guess all disabilities, but particularly for people with psychosocial disability who may experience levels of distrust or take a while to establish trust and rapport. So if they're asked to talk about their experience, tell their story yet again to a complete stranger, this actually may have an impact on their ability to engage with the NDIS and their ability to develop rapport. If the assessment is based on, you know, the information that they can get from, you know, a GP or a psychiatrist or psychologist whom they know, there is a much better chance that they will engage. The second middle box is that assessment currently is based on individuals' impairments and individuals' needs. The proposed assessment will be based on standardised assessment tools that may or may not be relevant for people with psychosocial disability. The third area is the knowledge when preparing for the evidence, I guess, to apply for the NDIS, that somebody's knowledge of previous hospitalizations, impairments over the past 6 months, or even longer for people with fluctuating conditions, it's actually critical to developing a pattern to see what kind of NDIS funding plan they will receive, whether they're eligible for the NDIS. It requires someone who knows them quite well as to, you know, what has been their experiences of mental health in the past. In the new assessments, an independent assessment will take 3 hours and got to collect all that information again. When I was actually preparing this presentation today, I did have a look at the Community Mental Health Association of peak bodies in August last year, prepared a response to the proposed new independent assessments. And they highlighted a number of criticisms, and they said before independent assessments can take place, it's important that the quality of the assessor is paramount, that they should, for people with psychosocial disability, they require a highly skilled and experienced assessor that is trauma-informed and recovery-focused and culturally aware. And that the quality of the assessment tools needs to work for people with psychosocial disability, and that 3 hours is just not enough to complete such an assessment. And that the availability of skilled assessors, especially in regional and remote areas, is important. So that's, I just guess, a look at how my research that was conducted in, you know, collected that information in 2018 and 2019 has relevance to today. The second theme is deconstructing choice and control. So this map, kind of mind map, plots the sort of themes that came out of this deconstructing choice and control area. And there's a number of areas where choice and control was actually deconstructed. It seemed to be the primary source of information for the primary pillar of the NDIS. And yes, it was. There were certainly some, opportunities for facilitating choice and control. But also I noted that there was quite a number of participants who had issues around using the word control. So here there was a Rania who's actually eligible. She found the whole idea of control and choice a little bit overwhelming. So she says, well, at the planning meeting, I just felt overwhelmed about the amount of choices, and the more options that you've given, the more unsatisfied you are with the selection because you're missing out on other things. She also said, I don't have control and sometimes I need other people to take control for me. This suddenly all this stuff is about the NDIS and they're supposed to be helping me, but I feel overwhelmed with it. Another example of control is of Esther, who has her actual mental illness is controlling in itself. So she found the word control very disturbing. I think control can sometimes be negative because my illness is highly controlling. So it's difficult to work out what is my need for control and what is largely dictated by the mental illness side of things, which can be maladaptive. There's others that got support and others who didn't. So I'll just talk about Janice's experience when she came to the NDIS. I mentioned before she pretty much got everything, but she didn't ask for $1 million home or anything like that, but she got counselling when she is needed. But one planner talks about we don't have to provide counselling because it's already sitting out there. You don't have to come to the NDIS for that. You've got Lifeline or your GP or other opportunities for counselling. I don't think the planner really understood the role of social support and counselling. The third and final theme is shaping recovery and social inclusion. I mentioned before that there's two different types of recovery. One is personal recovery approach and the other is a clinical recovery approach. The first one focuses on personal meaning, growth and discovery, while the other focuses on clinical or absence of symptoms using clinical language. The recovery here that is an illustration of the way that I tried to find out what people thought of recovery and the NDIS. So during the interview, I used 14 cards to give to participants to outline what their recovery goals were. And on the left-hand side of the page, I asked them to put down the cards what they thought recovery goals were important to them, and then asked them to identify an individual recovery goal. In this case, the person put to have time and facilities to paint and create art. And then I asked people to respond to whether they thought the NDIS was helping them meet their recovery goals. This was the impact, the potential impact. So and it just shows you that the recovery goal that was listed the most was the finding purpose and having hope. They were considered really important recovery goals. But their response where the blue line is that the NDIS did not really support them in their achievement of that recovery, especially for those who are ineligible. The sub-theme that I really identified was that what I call that's not very insurance-y. And this sub-theme transcends all the three themes that I mentioned before, choice and control and recovery and inclusion and access and equity. And I drew, attention to this because gave the label of this theme, that's not very insurancey. It's appropriated from an advertising campaign of Amy. And they challenge in their advertising campaign, they use this logo, this slogan, not very insurancey, to challenge the notion of what insurance can actually be and delivering insurance in a not very insurancey way. This insurance firm uses a slogan to promote their focus on customer needs, which they claim is innovative, flexible, but also efficient. Also an insurance model, the NDIS makes similar claims. But I think through my research, as that the NDIS falls short in meeting the benchmarks of insurance. So coming back to the main findings, I'm nearly concluding my presentation. And again, it's the main findings were that there were two pathways for people ineligible and eligible based on the structural design. That flexible support needs to accommodate episodic nature of illness, that mental health recovery knowledge by NDIS professionals was insufficient. And then finally, relating back to the Amy slogan, the NDIS insurance model design falls short of innovatively meeting the needs of people with mental illness. Before I close, I just want to just briefly tell you about the research advisory panel. I was absolutely thrilled to have an advisory panel which consisted of some professional researchers in community mental health organisations, a member of the National Disability Insurance Scheme, and significantly, two people who have lived experience of mental illness and the NDIS. Their input was invaluable to my research. They gave some excellent suggestions for ways that I could improve my research, and I am very grateful to their contribution. At the beginning of my presentation, I suggested my research was about pathways, and the pathway to recovery is often described as a journey. I discovered throughout my PhD journey that for the research participants, recovery is indeed a reality if the appropriate supports are in place. The stories of the 30 people interviewed in this study, I think serve as an important reminder of both the responsibilities and challenges that NDIS policymakers face in supporting people with psychosocial disability and instilling hope for a brighter future. They are also testament to the urgent task of ensuring the appropriateness of future policy provision and practice for reducing rather than entrenching inequity for those already marginalised in contemporary society. Thank you for being here today and showing your interest in my research.
Thank you very much, Liz. That was really useful. And there are so many complexities when it comes to the NDIS and the intersection with psychosocial disability. So I truly commend you for taking this one on. So I think before we go to questions, the first thing I would like to highlight is that the slides and the recording of this session will be available on the Diary website as usual. So you'll be able to look back and watch and get some of that information down. So we've got a question and answers now. So how do you think the newly announced mental health reforms in Victoria address the service gaps in access?
And it's a really good current question, I think, to ask, because the results of the Victorian Royal Commission into Mental Health, highlighted the needs for significant reform. And I, along with many of my colleagues where I currently work in mental health, we recognise that it is terrific that there are the reforms that address some of these gaps. So I'm hopeful that they will be able to address some of the gaps, especially for those who are ineligible for the NDIS, and that those reforms will be supportive.
Yeah, and hopefully it stays long-term rather than such a short-term thing. Okay, next one. We need to change the planning conversation. Are there assessments already out there that focus on strengths rather than deficits?
Yeah, That's a great question. And I know I haven't seen the full detail, but I mean, I alluded to this in my presentation, but the proposed assessments independent assessments that are proposed, they are for the NDIS, will there are flaws, definitely, and they'll need to be. I mean, I'm so grateful that of the strong advocacy to put those proposed assessments on hold while they're being reviewed. But the focus is supposed to be on strengths, but I haven't seen that kind of detail. I have had experience unrelated to my research in a strengths-based disclosure approach to managing disclosing your mental illness or psychosocial disability in an employment situation. And that actually uses a document that focuses on using words of strengths that actually the person with a disability determines what language to use when they're describing their disability. So it's a strengths-based and individualised approach. So I've seen some results, positive results from that research, and hopefully something like that will be utilised in future assessments.
Yeah, I think anything will be better than the independent assessment at this point, I think.
Yeah.
So we've got to the last question, which is a bit of a long one. So I'm going to look away from my screen. I'm interested in knowing about when the NDIS access applications were rejected. Did you explore the actual sections of the NDIS requirements that were not met? As a disability advocate, we regularly review applications for clients and advise accordingly. Very often, the provision of the right type of information is missing. Lots of evidence about diagnosis, but little about impact on the six domains of functionality. Generally, with our assistance, clients will meet the access requirements, sometimes after being rejected two or three times previously.
Mm-hmm. Did you get that? Firstly, can I commend you on supporting people in finding the right documentation and addressing functionality. It's critical to access the NDIS. Of the seven people who I interviewed who were not successful in getting the NDIS, five were in the process of appealing. So they knew the reasons why they weren't accessing, were rejected from the NDIS. The two people that were not going to appeal, they actually lost the desire and they weren't told the reason why they weren't. And so they just gave up. They resigned themselves, they weren't going to, and that's where their future was uncertain, their recovery uncertain. But for the others that were appealing, there were differences in the reasons for the rejection. I think three or four were related to the documentation wasn't enough to describe what impact has on everyday life, what the disability has impact on their everyday life. But for the others, it was actually, because it was early stages of the NDIS, it was just lack of knowledge about how to complete the forms, finding the right support person, so forth. So it did kind of vary. There were no uniform responses as to why they weren't successful, but it is terrific that there are organisations such as where the questioner comes from who actually supports people in their applications. Good on you.
Yeah, I can imagine how frustrating it must be, particularly if you have a mental illness on top of any other disability as well, and then having to go through that process again and again and again, and feeling like you would want to give up and just chuck it. I can totally understand that. Liz, thank you very much for being so generous with your time and expertise in this area. It's such a messy space to be in. Having some research and evidence about the impact of this process on people with psychosocial disability can really help to create change. So thank you very much.
My pleasure. Bye, everybody.
Come to a close to our last session of the series. So thank you to our Auslan interpreters and captioners for their hard work today. Thank you to Show Division for bringing this production to you today. Have a wonderful week, everyone. Stay safe and see you next time.